Today on Doomed! Everyone's talking about ivermectin. But what is ivermectin? And why has it become such a controversial topic? Even on where this show streams, people have been banned from discussing ivermectin on YouTube, or not banned, but their videos have been taken down. So what's going on here? Why are doctors prescribing ivermectin? Well, some doctors prescribing ivermectin. Why are other doctors, a lot of doctors, saying, hold on, ivermectin? And why has this all ended up with anti-vaxxers and vaccine skeptics going out and buying horse paste at feed stores? We're going to discuss all of this, make it all make sense, break it all down so you're walking away and you know what ivermectin is, what's going on in terms of COVID-19 and ivermectin, and you'll have it all set, no problem. And we'll only be dealing with factual stuff here. No misinformation, no fake news. You know how this show rolls. And to discuss ivermectin, I have a great guest, and let me bring us both up on the screen now. Because honestly, you can't talk about this unless you're talking to a medical professional. And I have a medical professional with us right here, right now today, Dr. Eric Osgood. He is an internal medicine doctor out of New Jersey. He's board certified in internal medicine. He's primarily a doctor who is a medicine doctor at hospitals, but also works with COVID-19 long haulers. Those are people who've got COVID-19, have got through it, are now no longer, they're no longer sick with COVID, but they're still dealing with lasting symptoms. And it's, we'll talk a little bit about that too, because I think that's a fascinating thing going on with people who have basically got through COVID-19, but are still dealing with the ramifications of it. Can I call you Eric or Dr. Osgood? What do you prefer?
Eric, definitely Eric.
Perfect. Eric, thank you so much for joining me today.
No, I'm happy to be here. I'm a big fan of yours, as I told you.
I really appreciate that. Thank you. When I reached out to you, I was thinking to myself, all right, how do we go about this? Because I know, how do I go about this? I mean, where do you start? Because there is a lot of news here, actually. You yourself have made a little bit of news because you were originally, and we'll get into this more a little bit later, but I want to bring this up top. You were originally with a group called the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance, FLCCC, who were sort of heralded at the beginning of the pandemic for coming up with, interesting ways to deal with, to tackle people, but tackle COVID-19 and people who are sick with it. And now they've become a very controversial group because primarily it seems because of ivermectin. But before we get too into that, what is going on here? Why has this become so controversial? What is ivermectin?
Yeah, so I'm hearing myself in the background as an echo. You're not hearing anything.
I'm not.
Funky,
you
though,
sound
right?
Great.
Everything's
on
good
my
on your end?
End. Yes.
All right. I'll just power through it then. All right. It's a little bit. I would not have assumed that this would be a gigantic culture war, like this medicine that's been around for a really long time that is being investigated as a potential therapeutic for COVID-19, I guess. But in today's world, in the way that everything becomes the subject of culture wars, I guess I shouldn't be surprised. How do we get to the point where people, rather than going and getting a life-saving, incredibly safe, effective vaccine that you can walk into and get in any retail pharmacy for free, that is proving to keep you out of the hospital, out of the morgue, and forego that, and then instead go to a tractor supply store or a feed store or a veterinary supply store and ingest horse medicine or sheep or dog medicine or whatever it is that people are doing? And there's that on the one extreme. And then there's people who are just basically saying, there's no possible way that this could work. This is a drug to kill worms. Why would anybody be stupid enough to think that it would kill a virus? And somewhere in the middle of that is an actual story that's based on science, medicine, and research that I think is a worthwhile conversation to have. I also think it's a worthwhile conversation because it's really it serves as a lesson in how things can get out of hand, how the over promotion and speaking with a degree of certainty that's not commensurate with the amount of scientific evidence you have can be the fuel for a lot of misinformation and for people to make very poor choices for their health and well-being. And the fact that there is a very sophisticated, well-formed anti-vaccine movement out there that is ready to pounce upon and infiltrate and utilize anything they can to exert their influence and get people to steer away from vaccines. And it turns out that the concept of quote-unquote early treatment or medical prophylaxis or medicine that you take that might, you know, keyword might, be able to offset disease severity or risk of COVID, to use that as some kind of promotion that they're lying to you and we don't really need vaccines and it's all a big pharma scam to push vaccines, and how they will push that message and how it becomes co-opted and incredibly dangerous. So the way this whole thing started is that the drug ivermectin, it is very much a human medicine. It has traditionally been very much a non-controversial medicine. It's been around for around 40 years. It's a known, very effective antiparasitic. It's really transformed the face of global human health in a lot of the developing world by eradicating diseases like African river blindness and other parasitic diseases. It's used off-label, meaning it is non-FDA approved to treat scabies and lice. And in fact, it's basically any residential setting like a nursing home, a prison, anything like that. One person in that facility gets scabies. Standard operating procedures, they exposure prophylax everybody with ivermectin. Note, it's not FDA approved for that condition. The World Health Organization approved, sort of gave its approval based on around 6 randomized trials. And so how do we get to the idea that it might do something in COVID-19?
Right.
So dating back to around 2012, virologists have actually been very interested in the antiviral properties of this drug. A lot of medicines go far beyond their original intended purposes, and this is a medicine that, at least in a laboratory setting, is very well known to have a broad spectrum antiviral activity against RNA and DNA viruses through a number of pathways. It is apparently, what we've seen in the lab is that it inhibits the formation of a protein that brings viruses into a nucleus. There are some computer modeling, what we call in silico studies, that suggest that the ivermectin molecule might bind really tightly to the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein. So it was thought maybe that will translate into some antiviral effect. And a number of others, and inhibition of like RNA-dependent RNA polymerase and others that it's known to do. I don't want to get too, you know, sciencey here.
Right.
And then there's a number of what we call host-directed mechanisms of action. So ivermectin is known to be a pretty powerful anti-inflammatory drug and what we call an immunomodulatory drug. So irrespective of its ability to actually do anything against a virus or pathogen, it's actually known to be pretty good at calming down the immune system when it's overactive. So it's used topically to treat rosacea, things like that. And so very early on, some virologists at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia, a very prestigious institute of virology, started doing experiments and kind of looking at different candidate drugs that might be possibly utilized to try to fight the COVID-19 pandemic. And what they found was that when they used what are called VRO-H SLAM cells, which come from monkey kidneys, they're a very commonly used cell line to test medicines and viruses. And they found that when they infected these monkey kidney cells with the SARS-CoV-2 virus, they were able to eradicate 99% of it within 48 hours using ivermectin. However, the concentration of ivermectin they had to use to exert that antiviral effect was massive, and way beyond what you'd ever be able to achieve with orally tolerable doses because of the bioavailability, how much actually builds up. And so you had this big split in the kind of medical scientific community where it's like, there's no way this is going to work. In another group that said, well, wait a second, like what happens in a test tube doesn't necessarily translate into what's going to happen in clinical practice. And it's probably worth looking into this further, and it's, you know, known to be a safe drug. And so human trials started, different types of observational studies, some randomized studies, all around the world started kicking off. And one thing that happened that was interesting that's undergone a lot of criticism is that a lot of South American countries, they just started like mass distributing this medicine to a bunch of people just hoping to stave off the pandemic,
right,
based on little to no human evidence. What you have to understand
first,
is that
I had actually first heard about it from use in India, where they were basically depending on it in India as well. I'm sure it's the same sort of situation when you have, you know, countries with mass populations and underdeveloped areas without you know, the means to really treat it properly, but they do have access to ivermectin, and they do know that it, what you, everything you just said about there's possibilities there. So, you know, when worse comes to worse and you got nothing else, seems like something you would, you know, if you're a doctor in one of those countries, find yourself be forced to experiment with.
Yeah, more or less. And I mean, here we think of this drug and it's kind of a little bit foreign and exotic to us. We don't know much about it. It seems kind of weird. In a lot of countries in the world, though, they use this medicine pretty frequently. It's really no big deal. They, you know, there's a lot of endemic parasites, and it's just like people got to take ivermectin from time to time. And so it would almost be like if we saw some limited studies that showed, hey, maybe if you take ibuprofen, maybe it'll fend off COVID, people would probably be trying it, even if there wasn't great evidence. And I mean, the safety profile is comparable, if not better, actually, for ivermectin when used properly under medical supervision, never veterinary products. In right. Self-directed use, buying medicines on the black market, you have no idea what you're getting. That's bad news. You know, another sort of basic science principle was they were actually testing what happened when rodents, like hamsters, for example, were infected with SARS-CoV-2. And these poor little hamsters lost their sense of smell, and they gave them ivermectin, and they actually found that the ivermectin-treated hamsters got their sense of smell back. Actually, the males more than the females, and it had nothing to do with antiviral properties. It had no effect on the virus, but it dampened what we call interferon responses. And so it was more of like, this may be doing something on the immune system. All right. So there you had this kind of like basic science basis for this medicine that may turn out to do something, may not. And, you know, people tried to track the results and, you know, do these studies to look at what happens when they mass distribute these drugs. And, you know, there were some graphs that were put out that suggested that there were decreases in case counts and COVID hospitalizations and deaths after these distribution campaigns. But there have been some criticisms raised of those because there's a lot of potential confounding factors. And there are a lot of other, you know, a lot of other things that could have been, you know, related, and waves go up and down. It's hard to nail down doing ecological studies. And then around, I would say, October of 2020, a handful of studies started uploading their results onto preprint servers, which means it doesn't get peer reviewed. You can just kind of post the result of your study for the scientific community to kind of engage in like pre-publication dissemination of new information and look at it. But you got to be careful because, again, it hasn't gone through peer review, and things, these articles and studies don't always hold up to peer review. But, you know, the FLCCC docs, who, as you mentioned, had been doing good, really good work at the beginning of the pandemic, you know, with things like corticosteroids, blood thinners, statins, they kind of caught wind of what a lot of doctors had been doing all around the world. And so the idea that they kind of thought of this first is not true. They kind of caught wind of what, you know, different physicians in different parts of the world were already doing. And actually, there's a lot of countries, I don't know, I don't say a lot, but there's definitely a handful, maybe a dozen countries or so, where it's actually in the national treatment guidelines. I should clarify, so we don't get dinged by the YouTube overlords, that the official position of the World Health Organization is they recommend against the use of it outside of a clinical trial. That is also the position of the CDC, the European Medicines Agency. The National Institutes of Health says they have insufficient evidence to recommend for or against it, and the FDA does not recommend it.
Right. I'm
just
glad,
to put that out there.
Thank you for doing that. But I think we're good, actually, because I think so far, you know, I have no question that we're going to be good, because the thing here is that I think it's interesting because obviously ivermectin use, from what we've been talking about so far, has been, you know, mostly pre-2021, pre-vaccines, where we're talking about, you know, if you've got, you know, basically it was doctors dealing with this rush of patients early on, not sure how to deal with COVID-19. Like you said, there were all these sort of different experimental treatments. I mean, experimental, I don't mean anything that's going to like cause harm to somebody, but I mean, you know, seeing what works. I remember early on reading a story about a doctor who found that there was this machine that they usually wouldn't use for patients that were, I don't remember exactly the details, but something like there was a machine where they usually wouldn't use for patients that have those symptoms, but for some reason he tried it with a COVID patient, and it was helping them. I don't recall, but obviously doctors were trying all these different things early on, with the goal being save as many people and try whatever we can until we figure something out to hold off for that vaccine.
Right.
And yeah. And it's weird to me how, you know, like you were saying, 2020, you got, you know, all these countries using ivermectin because they're doing what I just said. But now, you know, in the U.S., we're months into having a vaccine now, and I feel like we're just really getting into the ivermectin discourse. Like, I remember the hydroxychloroquine issue where Trump was promoting that early on, and that was a big thing in America, and you had people going out and taking it without doctor prescription, people taking the wrong thing. I remember there was a couple that like died from taking it, like a
fish
like,
tank cleaner.
Yes.
Fish tank cleaner.
Yes. And it's like, you know, we'll talk more about the issues there with, you know, with people, what people are doing now. But I did not hear ivermectin until, I have to say, this year. Like, I did not hear about it at all in 2020. Maybe it's my blindness to what was going on in other countries. But, I mean, it was not part of the American COVID-19 discourse at the very least.
No, not at all. And, I mean, the hydroxychloroquine, that, see, when we talk about trying things out, it's, you know, when you're in the position of having to treat people, you are, you know, they talk, the old saying is that you want to avoid the twin traps of overtreatment and therapeutic nihilism, where you don't want to expose people to any chemical or any intervention that might harm them. At the same time, if you sit back waiting for flawless evidence before you do anything, you can actually allow people to come to harm. And it's very much about finding and striking a balance between cautiously trying things based on plausibility or clinical observations, in some cases limited evidence, to try to help people. But you have to be very cautious, and you can never talk about things in a manner that is not commensurate with the evidence you have. You can't say something's a miracle cure when you have observational evidence to back you up, right? And that is what becomes a problem. And hydroxychloroquine was presented as some kind of magical cure-all, when in reality, there was a plausibility. It had shown potentially some antiviral activities, and it's known to calm, you know, an excessively overacting immune system. But what we found is that it wasn't really doing much, and that really kind of shook the medical community, because doctors were writing for that in the hospital en masse. And it turned out some evidence showed that it might have actually been worsening things, although I think that's been a little overblown too. And there have been a lot of other treatments du jour that turned out not to pan out, like convalescent plasma. You know, the research was back and forth, and ultimately the best evidence we have is that it really doesn't do much, if anything, in COVID-19. Actemra or tocilizumab was another one that, you know, there were studies that showed it worked, it didn't, it worked, it didn't. Overall, it looks like there is some benefit if used in a specific niche setting. You know, there was blood thinners, which now the Hep COVID trial, the best evidence we have now shows, if you start full dose blood thinning early on, you can save lives. But in the middle of that, there have been multiple studies that showed no benefit, possible harm. And there have been a number of things. And so the medical community, rightfully, it becomes very skeptical when anyone comes out and says, aha, we have the big cure that's going to save everyone's life. Because when you make grandiose claims like that, you got to be able to back it up with solid evidence. On the other hand, I think people in pop culture and sort of general discourse about medical culture tend to have the misconception that what doctors do is everything that they do is based on gold standard randomized control evidence. And in reality, particularly in infectious diseases, the majority of professional medical treatment guidelines are actually based on pretty low quality evidence, because sometimes clinical trials that are better designed are not feasible. They may be unethical in certain situations. They're just not tenable. And we're working with expert opinion, or working with like very limited case control or cohort studies. But as better evidence comes along, you have to follow that evidence. And if a medicine becomes an ideology, when another study comes along that's better, that says this isn't working very well, it becomes, well, that's a big pharma planted study. That's a big giant scheme to discredit this drug, as opposed to, okay, I'm going to modify my positions now that better research has come out and showed. And I've been able to do that because I'm not a zealot or an ideologue about medicine, versus a lot of people who have become real sort of ivermectin zealots. Any study that comes out that does not support the hypothesis is somehow like a fake study, or some kind of like Bill Gates plants. And, you know, unfortunately, I guess that's just the nature of the beast. What we've seen is that there have been multiple studies that showed benefit of ivermectin over control groups that have been fraudulent. And a number of the studies have not been of the highest quality. There are a handful of them that have been good. And what I see in the data leads me to believe that I think the majority of studies are actually ongoing. There's more studies coming in that are still being conducted than there are out. And I have a hunch that we are going to see some degree of benefit. And what really concerns me is that predominantly on sort of the center left and on the left, everyone is so excited to kind of dunk on this drug and say it's stupid and it's only for horses, and anybody who believes it might offer some benefit is just completely idiotic and what's wrong with you. And if it does show ultimately even a modest benefit, I don't know about you, I'm concerned about a gigantic, like, right-wing anti-vax like credibility boost, right? Where it's like,
I know what you're saying. Let's get that in a second, though. I don't think that, but I see the concern. I understand the concern. But before we get to that, I just wanted to say, you know, because it was interesting to me, because what you said is absolutely on point about it seems like there are people who are, like, you know, hanging their hat on ivermectin. Like, that's become part of their identity. And it's so bizarre to me. Like, I don't know if this is something that usually happens in the medical world. I mean, I know little to nothing about health and medicine. That's why I had to have you, a doctor, on to discuss this. But it seems bizarre to me because, like, I understand, actually, like, and I assumed that, you know, this COVID-19 new disease, new virus that just came in the past year and a half or so. Doctors were, you know, blindsided by it, not sure what to do, not sure what the proper stuff to give or to treat their patients with when this was first going on. So it made total sense that you would be trying different stuff. And I think that's totally fine for someone who is a professional, who knows, you know, the side effects and the proper dosages to even try with experimental drugs. It makes sense. And obviously, you know, if your family member is dying and from a sort of new disease, the new virus like COVID-19, what's the harm that's already going to – the harm is already happening. So you want a doctor to do whatever they think they can to try out. So I totally get that. But, you know, it seems to me that there is this weird thing where it's become part of – I've never seen this for medicine before, where people are arguing over, like, are siding with, like, a unproven medicine in either way, like you said. But I get the – I do get the left, though, because I'm in that group. You could check out some tweets, but I'm specifically talking about one specific thing. The horse paste thing. Like, I get – the dunking on people who are using it, because I'm not, and I think this is probably true of most people, because if you're knocking those people who are ivermectin zealots, you probably are, even in your lane where you believe in the science and following where results take us, and to see people go out and buy literal horse version of ivermectin, it's insanity, quite frankly. I mean, it's insane to see that. So I do think that's, you know, when people are talking ivermectin on the left and they're, you know, bringing up the horse paste online, I think they're definitely talking about that very specific group of people. Because listen, if you are someone out there who is sick with COVID and your doctor prescribed you with ivermectin in the human form, then I'm going to assume that your doctor knows your health and your what's good for you, and decided that what's the harm in trying this out? Because maybe you are you have some sort of immunocompromised position where you need it or something, whatever it may be. That you're not the person I'm talking about when I'm knocking the horse paste eaters. Mm-hmm. I'm literally talking about the people eating the horse paste.
Yeah, no, I mean, understandable. I mean, a lot of people are, you know, somebody actually gets it from a human physician and they'll make jokes. Oh, what kind of livestock animal are you? And I get it. It's comedy. It is funny. I can't. Comedy is comedy. And it does make for a funny story. But, you know, I think it's because it was so sort of overzealous and so over promoted. And you have people that had such distrust and fear in the vaccines, in this concept that they're all lying to us and they're trying to keep it, and that they just became desperate and couldn't find human doctors to prescribe them the human form. And they go read things online and they read things. People tell them, oh, it's the same thing. You just got to measure it out the right way and do the dosing conversion. And people actually think that's perfectly fine. What people should know is that the difference between livestock medicine and human medicine is not the actual, the active drug, but the percentage of impurities that are allowed by regulators is a lot higher in veterinary grade medicine.
Right.
So if you're ingesting medicine that's meant for horses, you are ingesting a degree of impurities that would never be allowed into human medicine. It's a terrible idea.
Right.
Furthermore, a horse is a pretty damn big animal, and you make one little mistake in your mathematical conversion, you could kill yourself pretty easily. I mean, the lethal dose is actually pretty high, but you can easily end up in a severe intoxicated state. And in a non-medically supervised position, again, overall, a very safe drug, but there are specific contraindications. If you have any kind of medical history where there's compromise to your blood-brain barrier, for example, this medicine can actually be a powerful neurotoxin and can be very dangerous. It has drug-drug interactions. So if you're on other medicines, that might potentiate those medicines or something, or vice versa. Like, doing things outside of the supervision of a physician in general is not a good idea. In taking any medicine that's not human grade is an awful idea. Yet people became so much in a craze in this concept of they're hiding the truth from us, and it's a big conspiracy, and doctors won't prescribe it because they're afraid, and they're all hiding the truth. That conspiratorial thinking, people take things to extremes, and now look, you see, you know, rises in calls to poison control centers. People are literally ingesting animal medicine, when in reality, in other countries, they're prescribing the human version pretty routinely, and they must be looking at us like what is wrong with you? You've got, like, people who want to try this medicine are not finding doctors who will prescribe it. They're ingesting veterinary versions, yet at the same time, it's being over-promoted as some kind of cure-all, when that's absurd. Like, it may have an my best guess is it may have an adjunctive benefit, meaning when it's added on to other therapies, it may, you know, reduce disease severity to a certain degree. That's not the same thing as being a cure, and that's not the same thing as, like, not needing a vaccine. That's absurd. And I don't know if you want to get into what happened with FLCCC and how that whole...
I do, but I just want to ask you another question about this, because God forbid, and I want to make sure, if you are someone watching this, I'm going to assume my audience is not, but if you're someone who just stumbled upon it on YouTube, on YouTube, Twitch, the podcast... and you're listening and you just happen to have your newly bought apple flavored ivermectin horse tube next to you, and you're thinking about taking it after coming across it on Facebook. What could happen to you? Because one thing I will say, like you said, with the hydroxychloroquine people who took the wrong thing and people died. I have yet to, and knock on wood, I have yet to hear that anyone died from taking too much of the ivermectin horse dewormer. Mm-hmm. But I have heard people get very sick. I've heard people have bowel issues. I've seen something. I brought it up last week, and a veterinarian called into the show to tell me that people should absolutely not do this, where people who were taking the paste, the horse paste version, didn't like the taste and were considering taking it anally, like up the butt. What could happen to you if you take this, and and obviously you shouldn't be, but how sick can you get? What could go on here?
People are gonna take this rectally, you're saying?
That's what I saw in a Facebook group that talked about it. And there are people who are talking about how they were losing their, you know, their ability to control, going to the bathroom. Like, they were just, you know, going.
Yeah.
I don't know, if they took it rectally or ingested it normally, those specific people, but from what you understand, just taking the wrong thing, the wrong version of ivermectin, like, what could happen to you? I want to make sure people know that, this is not something you should do.
A confusion, disorientation, nausea, vomiting, convulsions, visual disturbances, tremors, severe lightheadedness, severe fatigue and somnolence, so basically like a neurotoxin, severe gastrointestinal symptoms, diarrhea. Those are kind of like the big ones, liver injury. Those are kind of the biggies.
Now, I want to make sure I'm following here too, because I've seen people, and this is always bizarre to me. I've seen people talk about, you know, they take it once they get COVID. And then I've seen people talk about, and this is usually the horse paste people, because obviously your doctor probably isn't going to prescribe the human version to a completely healthy person who's not got COVID. I've seen people talk about taking it beforehand as like a preventative measure? Is that, mm-hmm. is that a thing?
It is. Yeah. So there's pre-exposure prophylaxis and there's post-exposure prophylaxis. And both of these have been studied. So for example, the All India Institute of Medical Sciences, a doctor over there published a case control study of healthcare workers, again, early on in the pandemic, way before vaccines. And he did a retrospective analysis of those who took it like once a month versus those who didn't take it, and actually saw like a pretty significant reduction in the group that took it. But again, retrospective case control studies, there are a lot of potential confounders there. You don't want to use a study like that to make a conclusion. Then there was another doc in Bangladesh who did a very similar study, once a month dosing. He followed healthcare workers for 4 months. At the very end, like it was something like 70% less in that ivermectin group were actually came down with symptomatic COVID. And then that AIMS doctor then did a prospective cohort study published in Curious, which isn't exactly like a top medical journal, but apparently did something like 3,500 healthcare workers, and about 60% of them took two doses of 0.3 milligrams per kilogram, pretty standard dosing. And then about 35% of the healthcare workers took just one dose of it. And then about 5% of them took one dose of it. And then about 35% of them just opted out and said, I'm not taking it. And there was something like an 82% reduction in the members of the group that took two doses who got symptomatic COVID compared to the other one. So and then there was another study that was also a retrospective study in the Dominican Republic where they did the same thing. And they found similar results. Now, none of these are the gold standard evidence. None of these are randomized, blinded, investigator, subject blinded, placebo controlled. But these have been some of the studies that were observed. Now, there is one study that people were quoting all the time down in Argentina, where they supposedly treated like 1,200 healthcare workers. I don't know if you caught this, but in BuzzFeed, my new friend Gideon Meyer with Katz, health nerd as he goes by on Twitter, and his team Kyle and they've been sort of trying to tackle all the fraudulent studies that have been going on. And they just wrote this sort of blockbuster article that indicates that that study was likely that either didn't happen or there's a tremendous amount of sort of research misconduct involved in that study. Mm-hmm. And then there's another study out of.
Is that related to that big study that was being touted by all the, like we mentioned before, the ivermectin zealots that ended up being retracted because it was based on, you know, the doctor who put it together basically was using other people's studies to put together this paper, and then he found out that those studies were bogus or something was wrong with them. You probably know better than me. That the one you're talking about?
No, so this is another one. So all right, I'll try to clear this up. There's a study that was not published. It was put up on a preprint server. It had gotten rejected from like I think 7 journals. And it was done out of Egypt, I think Benha University. And the apparent study was that they gave this pretty big dose to different groups of hospitalized patients. And then they did what's called a post-exposure, where they gave household members of people who were infected ivermectin and then compared them to control groups. And they reported this like huge reduction in deaths. And that was really driving that meta-analysis, meaning when we looked at all the different studies and looking at an overall mortality benefit, that one study was really heavily driving that result of mortality benefit. And it was basically discovered that that study was basically fabricated. And so they had to redo that meta-analysis, excluding that study. And then that, you know, it became much, there still was a slight favor toward the ivermectin, but the confidence interval widened to what we call including the null, meaning it's possible that the overall observed effect is no benefit. This study is not a randomized trial, so it was not part of that meta-analysis, but it was touted by a lot of people where, you know, in South America, supposedly they took ivermectin drops, the healthcare workers, and then the addition to that, they used this thing called iota carrageenan, which is based on seaweed. It's been shown to have some antiviral properties, and that you put it inside your nose. It's like a paste, and apparently the healthcare workers were doing that 5 times a day, taking ivermectin. And they compared like 800 people who were doing that to like 420 something people who didn't. And they reported that out of the 788 people who did that, not a single one got sick with COVID. It was 100% effective. And like half of the people, the healthcare workers who didn't do this protocol got sick with COVID. And that's the, you know, that Brett Weinstein was saying, well, if this is true, it's 100% perfect cure. Why do we need vaccines? Right. Well, turns out that study is probably bogus. Either, you know, the results were fabricated, data was fabricated. I don't know what happened with it, but if you want to read that study in BuzzFeed, that article that just came out in BuzzFeed hours ago, these investigative journalists just did a phenomenal job of looking into that as well. So
I've not seen that yet. I have to take a look. Is this something that normally happens in the medical world? Because it does seem like there are, I don't know, but maybe this is something that usually happens, but I've never heard of, like, you know, all these, you know, in this specific case, all these ivermectin studies ended up being just like fraudulent or bogus or just not legit. Is this something that usually happens, or is this a case of, like you mentioned earlier, people are tying their careers to ivermectin and doing whatever they can to promote it?
Yeah, I mean, there's always been research fraud and research misconduct, but the degree of, I mean, then there was that whole Surgisphere thing we didn't even get into, like that, you know, that was all based on like nonsense data collection. But the degree of like wacky research and like sort of discredited shenanigans research that's gone into this one drug baffles me. And I think the problem is, like, if this medicine works, that's a big problem, because now you're creating further distrust in it. And if it doesn't work, that's all. I mean, I honestly think people that can engage in fraudulent research and disseminate findings during a pandemic should be tried criminally, because, I mean, you are both engaging in behavior that is driving doctors to potentially practice in a way that's not based on good science, and you're potentially eliminating the trust. Like, we as doctors in the international medical community have to be able to have trustworthy peer-to-peer like dissemination of our findings. And if we're not going to trust each other because there's so much fraudulent stuff going on, that hurts the medical profession. It's a gigantic threat to global public health and safety. And that's a big problem. So because these individual studies were either fraudulent or involved a lot of research misconduct, does that mean the drug doesn't work? No. But it's a big problem. And, for all those reasons I listed, this is like a clear and present danger to global health.
Right. Now you mentioned Brett Weinstein before, and it seems like there have been a lot of people, and for people who don't know, he's one of the leading members of the intellectual dark web, that group that includes people like Dave Rubin and Joe Rogan. And Joe Rogan's another one of these guys. I don't know if Rubin got on board, but it wouldn't surprise me. These guys are all sort of backing, like you said, they're tying it to their political ideology. Ivermectin is their thing. They're defending it. They're and a lot of it has to do with obviously we mentioned that we've been mentioning it throughout, that we're being careful. Not really though, because I'm not really worried about it actually, obviously. But there was one or two times where he mentioned, making sure to be straight due to YouTube's different guidelines and how they deal with COVID-19 misinformation. Specifically, Brett Weinstein's complained that he's had his ivermectin episodes taken down. I know that one individual, Dr. Corey of that group that you were once a part of, the FLCCC, had his congressional hearing taken down from YouTube. But at the same time, if you go to YouTube right now and you type in ivermectin, and I've watched a few, you see hours-long streams from doctors and other professionals talking about ivermectin in the same way that we are. And those are up on the channel and on YouTube, no problem. And I think the difference is that we are discussing it legitimately and discussing it within the confines of what the science says about it, and not, like you've mentioned throughout as well, talking about it as if it's some miracle cure or miracle drug, because it's not. Right. And, the thing I'm getting to here, though, is that there's been, and I think this is probably what's hurting ivermectin in terms of legitimate use cases for it, and that is the grift that surrounded it. There was a report from NBC News, I believe it was early this week or last week, about the website speakwithanmd.com that's tied to a group called America's Frontline Doctors. And for people who don't recall, America's Frontline Doctors were those doctors that Donald Trump would bring out during the pandemic when he was president, to basically push hydroxychloroquine and all other sorts of experimental drugs that were being touted by Trump as the miracle cures. One of these physicians part of that group, Dr. Stella Emanuel, people looked into her and found that she was talking about how like different cancers are due to people having sex with demons. A very odd group. But the reason NBC News covered this, and I believe Ben Collins, who's been on the show before, was the journalist behind it, the report, is that a lot of people were buying the ivermectin human pills from that website tied to that group, speakwithanmd.com, and it was all about, right, the money. I mean, it seems like anyone could have gone to that site and got a prescription, if they paid the price, for ivermectin, which seems like a bad idea. And obviously it makes people—
That's not medicine. That's not medicine.
Go ahead. I mean, I'm basically just, you tell me, you know, the idea that you would buy anything like this. I mean, obviously there are drugs that you could get over the counter. Tylenol for a headache, you know, all sorts of different drugs like that. But it seems like the drug that can help you get through COVID-19 is not quite the type of drug that would be sold over the counter. I mean, I throughout my life, whenever I got like a cold or something, I would have to go to the pediatrician when I was a kid, and usually I would get the wonderful bubblegum tasting amoxicillin. Seems like a really simple thing. Kids would take it and get better. But you couldn't get it over the counter, a drug even just like that, which seemed pretty low bore to me. I don't know. But ivermectin seems like something that should not be sold in that way.
Well, in a lot of parts of the world, it is over the counter, actually.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Yeah, it actually is. Not in the U.S., though. But yeah, I think actually when I was on TMBS, I think in like late October, I went on there to just kind of give my story of what it was like to be a doctor in the pandemic. And I talked about America's frontline doctors and actually contrasted it with the frontline COVID-19 critical care lines, because they both had that frontline work. And I hadn't met any of them yet. This is just like I knew who they were. And they were part of my story because their steroid protocol was part of how like we got things to be, you know, to get a lot better in the hospital and whatnot. And I pointed out that America's Frontline Doctors was basically like an AstroTurf kind of right wing operative group. And whenever they talk about hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, and when you look at the way that like the Brett Weinstein and the IDW folks talk about this medicine, call me cynical and call me skeptical, but I just don't think global human health is their project the way that it might be mine or yours. And I think it's more like question the establishment, man. They're lying to us. They, you know, the Fauci doesn't know, or the government's bad, right? It's all about that, like making you skeptical that there's really any expertise and that you can trust them, and that listen to us and look at this. Here's the real doctors who are telling you the truth, and they're on our show, and those doctors don't want you to know the truth. Like, that's their project, not actually like, boy, it would be great if this medicine worked because, you know, it could improve global human health and potentially reduce harm with this disease. I just, call me crazy, I just don't have a lot of faith in the idea that they're coming at it with the same, you know, standpoint as other people are. And then same thing, like Fox News, they would have, you know, they had Pierre Corion and other people, and like I talked to him before he kind of did that tour and went on Weinstein and went on Rogan and was going to go on Maria Bartiromo. And I said, like, and I was an advisor to the group. I wasn't a core member. So I was just kind of always giving my advice. And my advice was always like, this is low certainty evidence, promoted as such. You know, the goal is supposed to be getting NIH and other groups to study this drug, not promoting it as a miracle cure. And if you're going to go on these shows like Fox News or whatever, they're using you to promote their goal, which is Democrats are bad, you know, the authorities and, you know, health experts are bad, and they want to make people angry and distrustful. And if you let them co-opt that message, they're going to do just that. And I think that and like the anti-vax community has pounced on this whole thing as a way to kind of promote their objectives, and that's kind of the way I've seen this play out. But I just don't think there was enough done to counteract that and to be kind of savvy about that and to not let that happen. And then of course that led into like the just failure to promote vaccines as the number one way that you prevent the transmission and the disease severity of COVID-19 And it's like you got this whole page dedicated to prevention, and you have these different medicines and quercetin and vitamin C and zinc and vitamin D and whatever else. Fine, that's all well and good. But how do you not have vaccines at the very top of that?
Right.
And by not having vaccines at the very top of that, you are, if not explicitly, at least tacitly promoting the idea that, hey, it's okay to do these things instead of getting the vaccine. And that's how people are interpreting it. And that's how they are communicating it in their circles. And it got to the point where, like, no matter what I said, that wasn't making a difference. It was made clear to me that the vaccine stance is going to remain kind of cautious. And yes, there were, you know, they're effective and talk to your doctor, but it was never going to be like a, hey, we're an organization that says go get vaccinated. And I said, I just can't be a part of an organization that's not going to be promoting vaccination. Even, you know, it just got to the point where I had no illusions that I might be able to change things or to kind of calm the messaging down or anything like that. And I just kind of had like an oh shit moment, like, oh my God, like I'm part of a group that's basically linked to people thinking that they can either use a human or veterinary product that's unproven instead of getting a vaccine. And like I had like a full blown panic attack, because it's like it's kind of like the frog in the slowly boiling pot. Like these things kind of happen slowly, and it kind of went from like, okay, like we feel like there's a lot of research centers around the world that have done some interesting studies that are promising on this drug, and our goal is to get NIH to do a study, and maybe McMaster University and others to, and then it sort of drifted to no more studies. We already know it works. No more putting people in placebo group. Now it's promotion. Get the word out. Convince everybody. Tout it as a miracle drug. And it's like, wait a second. The point was supposed to be to study the drug. Now all of a sudden it's an ideology. Studies are bad. And now it's like, if you don't believe that this medicine should be in every medicine cabinet, standard of care for COVID-19, you're either like in on it, or you're a pharma shill, or you're captured, or like, so it's just, things just kept getting more and more conspiratorial. As the disease kept ramping up more and more, and the Delta variant, and more hospitals were filling up, and it was 99% people who were unvaccinated. It's just anything that any group is doing, either explicitly or implicitly, that's leading people not to get the vaccine is like a gigantic public health threat. And, I felt the need to kind of speak up publicly about that.
Now, what do you think the reasoning is for the FLCCC to go so, to hunker down and completely, you know, attach themselves to ivermectin? Because, you know, we were just talking about America's Frontline Doctors and their site, not their site, but the one they have a connection to, Speak With An MD. And we discussed, you know, obviously there's the grift there. There's a money incentive to just getting people this ivermectin over the, basically over the counter. And they're, you know, selling it at a high price for people who to buy it. But what, because the FLCC, unlike that other group, it did seem like they were they had an air of a legitimacy around them early on. Like I mentioned at the very top of our discussion, you know, they came up with like a, what is it, the mask plus?
The math plus.
Math
plus.
And what is that, just so people understand? Because that was, I believe that's something that was rolled out and people use that to basically treat people with COVID in terms of like how to go about when someone comes into the hospital.
Yeah, no, that's a cool story. And yeah, I mean, the core members of this group are like very highly respected in their field, each pioneers of major modalities in critical care medicine. You know, Pierre Corey is sort of a pioneer and textbook author of what we call POCUS, point of care ultrasonography in the ICU. So using ultrasound rapidly at the bedside to quickly diagnose potentially life-threatening conditions. You know, Dr. Varone is part of the pioneering of what we call therapeutic hypothermia. So cooling people down when they've had an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest to help preserve their brains. Umberto Maduri is considered global expert in the use of corticosteroid in lung disease and so on and so forth. And so at the very beginning of the pandemic, in the hospital, the treatment that was being recommended by all the, what I'll call the global health authorities, whether NIH, CDC, WHO, was just like, just do supportive care. It's a viral illness. You know, some people get better, some won't. Give them oxygen, give them ventilatory support, kind of hope for the best. Give them Tylenol, cough medicine, vitamins, fluids. But whatever you do, do not give them corticosteroids. Corticosteroids are basically a medicine that we use to calm down hyperinflammation. So we use it in asthma attacks, multiple sclerosis attacks, things like that. And the idea was, well, in a viral lung illness, you don't want to be using corticosteroids, because if you suppress the immune system, the virus might grow faster, make it worse. And what these doctors figured out very early on is that when you're sick in the hospital with COVID-19 and you've got that pneumonia, that lung injury, that low oxygen, it's actually not a viral pneumonia. Your body has dispatched with the virus. That virus is broken into pieces, and those pieces of viral RNA are now what we call reactogenic. Those are triggering a severe immune response. So it's an inflammatory lung injury that 100% needs steroids. And so against almost complete scientific and medical consensus, they created and disseminated a protocol that was centered around the use of methylprednisolone, which is a corticosteroid. And they got creamed at the time. They were getting discredited and maligned and told that they were being reckless, dangerous. And the other thing, the H stands for heparin, which is a blood thinner that we use. We give through a continuous infusion through the IV to treat either heart attacks, blood clots. What doctors knew on the front lines was that patients with COVID-19 were dying because they were clotting severely. And if you wait too long and you wait for them to start clotting and then try to thin the blood, they both bleed and they clot. And so you really have to start it early. And that was seen as crazy. Wait, you're putting people on full blood thinners when they're coming in with COVID infections. Both of those things have since been vindicated and essentially standard of care, widely understood to be life-saving in the hospital. And we really didn't get that data until months and months later. And so this was a group that was very well known for kind of pioneering the best way. Now, they used dexamethasone in that big trial. So most people use dexamethasone, methylprednisolone. They're just two different types of a steroid. But the bottom line is that in the hospital, this is a steroid-responsive lung injury. And Dr. Corey, what a lot of people don't know, is that the first time he went before the Senate to testify was actually on May 7th, 2020. And it was to give a testimony that it's crazy that we're not using corticosteroids in the hospital as standard of care. That actually got taken down from YouTube as well. And then I think it was about like 6 weeks later, that's when the big trial came out, Recovery, where dexamethasone was proven to be life-saving. So when I first heard about ivermectin sometime in like October, somebody sent me a link. My first instinct was to roll my eyes. And then when I saw who was behind it, that made me take a second look, just because I was so familiar with the work that those doctors had done early in their pandemic. That caused me to look at the data a little bit more and come to the conclusion that this is something that should probably be subjected to more rigorous clinical trials. We should figure out if this works or not. And I mentioned it in that interview I did. And if anybody wants to ever go back and watch that interview, I was very clear. I'm not saying people should start taking this. I'm not saying people should be stockpiling this. I'm not promoting this as a cure. What I'm saying is there's a signal here and that we need better studies. And it was after that that the FLCCC contacted me, because someone sent them a link to that interview, and I talked to them. And again, at the time, the goal was no one's looking at this drug. The NIH isn't looking at this drug. The CDC isn't looking at this drug. The WHO isn't looking at it, really. Let's bring attention to some of this research, which is acknowledged as being pretty low certainty, low quality research. And ultimately, that's been accomplished. The National Institutes of Health is doing the Active 6 trial, where they're looking at repurposed drugs. They're studying ivermectin. The University of Minnesota is doing the COVID out trial, where they're looking at it along with other drugs. The principal trial in Oxford is doing a huge trial. They're looking at it. And there's a handful of other big phase 3 trials that are looking at it. And to me, good. Mission accomplished. The drug's being investigated. See what the research shows. But unfortunately, there's been this mission creep to, no. It's now somehow unethical to put people in placebo because we know this drug works. And no, it should just be in every medicine cabinet. Everybody should be taking it. And we have a term in science and medicine called equipoise, which means there's at least enough of a non-consensus and sort of an expert opinion where some people think something works, some people think that it doesn't. That's what we call equipoise. And by definition, it's ethical to put people into a placebo group and compare it if you're still in equipoise, versus once you really know something works, it does become unethical to study it and put somebody else in a placebo group where they could come to harm. That's being completely abused. And there's these suggestions that no, we have such high certainty and we know that this drug works, that no more studying it. Just use it, and everybody should be using it. And if you're not using it, and if you're expressing any doubt about the efficacy, you're somehow, you know, captured by big pharma. And I'm accused of that now, or I'm accused of like changing my mind and flip-flopping when my position has been the exact same the whole time. This is low certainty evidence of a safe drug without many effective alternatives. And that type of evidence is the basis for a lot of practices in infectious disease. So in a risk-benefit analysis, it's reasonable to try things as long as you are clear and upfront with your patient of your uncertainties, risks, benefits, alternatives, and that you don't go over promoting things and speaking about them in a manner that's not commensurate with your scientific certainty. And that's done all the time in medicine. And again, if better studies start coming in showing us that we overestimated the effect, or that maybe people are coming to harm, it's not doing well, we have to be able to modify our positions. We have to be able to put human health above our own egos about being right. And if you can't do that, you're not practicing medicine, you're practicing ideology. And that's horrifically dangerous, because the public is counting on us to be scientific and not to be ideologues and zealots.
Right. That's well said. So what do you think, though, is that, like, why would a group that, like you just said, you know, it has so many respected members and, you know, why are they so adamant about? And when I say they, it's weird because the only one I ever see on shows or anything is Dr. Corey. Is it just him that's ruining the name? I don't know. Again, is it just him that's bringing this group down this path, like, and like bringing everyone down with him? Like, what is obviously they're not innocent if they're going to let this one, if that's true, that's one person tarnish the name of everybody else. So, you know, on them too. But what is going on here? Because again, I don't see the, like with that Trump group, I don't see the monetary grift here. Is it just to make a name for yourself or for future, maybe, you know, I don't know, for future earnings? I have no idea. What is going on?
I'll do my best to answer this. And by the way, Pierre and everyone else in that group is like, they're like all lifelong Democrats. I think there's like some assumption that they're all right wingers. They're really not.
Oh, to be fair, though, when it comes to health stuff, the people on all, it's where everyone's been. I mean, usually when you think of anti-vaxxers, obviously there are the real people who are religious, and that's usually more on the right. But there was always like the hippies who didn't want their kids to get vaccinated. And so when it came to anti-vaccination and alternative medicines and depending on those instead of, you know, using that as supplementary if you're into that stuff, that's been something everyone's been involved with to their detriment.
It's true. No. So, yeah, I guess the best way, and like, you know, I got to know Pierre. I consider him a friend. But honestly, I think he has just become, unfortunately, radicalized. And I think to some degree, coming up in the beginning of the pandemic with this treatment protocol, which proved to be effective, getting absolutely maligned and creamed by the medical profession. And then ultimately what ended up happening was when that trial came out showing that, in fact, dexamethasone steroid was helpful. There was an article in the New York Times where they interviewed a bunch of people, including the chief editor in chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. And they said, oh, he just got lucky. And then to come up with this medicine and to be using at the bedside and seeing benefit in trying to get the word out. And I think having people not listen to you. And I think more and more and more just he's become just like ingrained in the idea that this medicine 100% works. And that, like, there's just kind of forces that are trying to nail it into the ground to pave the way for pharma and vaccines and whatnot. I mean, we don't have to be naive. I think pharmaceutical companies that are trying to develop new antiviral drugs probably aren't going to be psyched if an old generic medicine works. I mean, that's not conspiratorial. That's just, you know, basic, like, you know, capital. But
also, isn't like, idea. I mean, the company that makes ivermectin, Merck, I mean, they're not like, you know, Grandpa Jim and Mima running the ivermectin laboratory in their little farmhouse. Like, it's not like a small business. This is a big, big company that came out and said, don't take ivermectin.
Ivermectin is generic. And so the amount of the global ivermectin supply that actually comes from Merck is probably like 2%. So if you get ivermectin, it is a very small chance that you're actually going to get a Merck Stramectol pill. So they are actually coming out with a drug called molnupiravir, and they've already signed a deal with the government where they're going to get like, you know, X number of billion of dollars if that drug actually passes phase 3 and gets an EUA. So that's where their money is. They're not, trust me, they're not hoping that any generic medicine that might kind of compete with their new baby is going to end up working. Although, I mean, I guess you could say use both together, but I think in general, they're not particularly psyched about the idea that that medicine could work. Now, does that mean there's a big pharma conspiracy trying to? No, of course not. But just in general, you know, companies coming out with de novo antivirals are not going to be psyched about generic things working. But that's not even the point I'm making. The point I'm making is that I think that just the psychological effects of what he went through, I guess, I'm not trying to make excuses for anybody, just has made him double, triple, quadruple down. And unfortunately, the promotion and sort of it became very clear that he was like, I'm not talking about the science anymore. I'm not talking about the data anymore. I am convinced this is not a data argument, and this is just an argument about the forces and the dynamics that are trying to suppress this drug. And, you know, this became his opinion. This became his standpoint. And basically started doing these media tours and going on, you know, the Dark Horse and Rogan and then Marita Bartiromo and Fox News alongside Ron Johnson and all these different shows in Ireland and other parts of the world, just basically saying, like, if you don't think this drug works or if you are doubtful about its efficacy, then, like, that's evidence that somehow, you know, there's a capture, there's some kind of, like, pharma plot to sink this drug. Now, your question about the rest of the FLCCC, the majority of the docs in the group weren't really very involved with ivermectin, or they were, like, agree that, like, there's a signal and we you know, think it works and there's benefit and the trials are going to show benefit. But the ones I spoke to in the group were also very uncomfortable with its overpromotion and were extremely uncomfortable with even the suggestion or hint that it could be used as a vaccine alternative, and were actually quite disturbed by that. But unfortunately, the actual group's media activity and what's said on behalf of the group and what the group posts on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, like, the majority of doctors in the group don't really have any influence on that. And so when people say the FLCCC, I think there's a lot of doctors in that group that get kind of, like, lumped in with it that don't really have much to do with that, the kind of ivermectin promotion. What I said was, like, it's not enough to just not be comfortable with it. You have to be vocal and you have to speak up and say something. And that's, you know, the reason I very publicly left the group was because of that. And really, I think if the group had continued with, you know, here's IMS Plus, we understand there's parts of the world that can't get vaccines and we think this helps. And in post-exposure prophylaxis, early treatment, we think these protocols are good. But first and foremost, if you're in an area that has vaccines, if you're in a country where you have, like, get the vaccine, please, like, I wouldn't really see much wrong. And if it just emphatically coming out saying no medicine, ivermectin or anything else is a vaccine replacement, like, I don't think anybody would really be motivated to go after them, to be honest. I don't think we'd be having this controversy. But I think any force, any influence that someone puts out there that is going to contribute to people making the decision not to get immunized, is doing real harm. And I don't think you can cop out of that by saying, well, we're not telling people not to get vaccinated. We're acknowledging that vaccines are part of the strategy and you should talk about it with your own doctor and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Oh, by the way, ivermectin. If your doctor won't give you ivermectin, here's a directory of doctors that will give you ivermectin. Oh, no, but both are good. Like, you can't play that game.
Right.
Like, I'm not going to play that game. And I'm going to call it out. And if you know, people want to be mad at me or suggest that I'm a turncoat or anything like that. Again, my project, my interest is human health. And I don't want to be a part of anything and I don't want to be tacitly involved in anything that is going to impact human health in a negative way.
Have you, it sounds like you have you received blowback? Cause I have seen that apparently, Dr. Corey has gone, after that. No, when I say gone after, I mean, like, tweeted nastily at him.
Andrew Hill.
Yeah, the doctor, that respected doctor who originally had that study out, though, that everyone was citing, and then retracted it once he found out that it wasn't, on the up and up, which is legit. People make you know, as a journalist, this is what happens. Sometimes you have to issue a correction or retract, and that's what makes you legit for coming out and doing that when you find out that there's incorrect information. But Dr. Corey went after him online and said nasty things about him. And have you received a similar sort of blowback?
Am I allowed to swear on your show?
You can fucking say whatever.
All right. Yeah, no, I think the actual tweet was, your fake ass something or other is bullshit, fuck you, or something like that. It was the tweet. And I was like, well, I mean, Andrew Hill has done more than just about anybody to try to investigate the therapeutic possibilities of ivermectin. If that's the bad guy, I don't know what to tell you. How is he the bad guy? And he hasn't just, I mean, his entire existence during this pandemic has been the global search for cheap, safe, repurposed, scalable medicines to try to put a dent in this pandemic. He's looked at a whole bunch of candidate medicines. The guy's doing phenomenal work, and I don't know him personally, but from everybody I talk to who knows him, a good guy. And his meta-analysis that was put up on OFID, Open Forums Infectious Disease, showed a mortality benefit. Now, that mortality benefit, when you take that Al-Ghazar study and that NIE study, which is another one that was raised as potentially problematic, that statistically significant mortality benefit kind of goes away. However, his study also showed a number of other interesting endpoints, like time to viral clearance. In other words, how quickly do you either turn to testing negative or you don't. So there's a bunch of other studies that looked at what we call virological endpoints, and I think those still hold up. Now, the question is, will that be connected to what we call patient-centered outcomes? So, okay, ivermectin has antiviral properties, and it makes people either test negative sooner or maybe makes the virus clear more quickly than it would without it. Is that going to be connected to dying less, going to the hospital less, having a fever for fewer days, being contagious for a fewer number of days? That kind of remains to be seen. The tricky thing about studying COVID-19 is that because most people go on to survive and to recover, to show a mortality benefit, your study has to be pretty big. Otherwise, you don't have enough power to show that benefit. So what they try to do is add up a bunch of individual studies and add up how many people in the ivermectin arm died, in the ivermectin arms either died, went to the hospital versus not. To begin with, you got to be careful with that kind of research because they use different dosing, different timing. When you give the ivermectin in the hospital or like late 7-10 days, and you're really relying more on its anti-inflammatory properties versus if you do a study where you administer it within like the first 72 hours of symptoms, you're using it more as an antiviral, and that makes a big difference in how you study it. And so he and his team did one of the most sophisticated, elegant analyses of this drug and all the existing randomized trials that I've seen. So to go after him like he's a bad guy just blows my mind. Another guy who's doing really important work is Dr. David Boulware. I'm going to give him a shout out too. University of Minnesota, involved in NIH, infectious disease specialist, mycologist. I've had a chance to have a lot of nice chats with him. He's very much trying to, in the COVID out trial, look at both ivermectin as well as things like metformin, fluvoxamine. And he has been the subject of a lot of mistreatment and accused of like being some kind of, I don't know, Mengele and Nazis and all Nuremberg, all kinds of nasty references, because how dare you put somebody in a placebo group with this life-saving cure that you know works. Like, he's actually, guys like Dr. Boulware and Hill are the guys who are actually trying to do the kind of research that will move experts and that will move panels to make a recommendation, and they're now being demonized as the bad guy. That's just like, that's bonkers. I mean, but at the same time, you got people running around saying, this is horse paste and nothing more. This is a horse dewormer. Why would it work for COVID? That's also stupid. We are actually doing very legitimate clinical trials to try to answer this question. And So it's almost like I feel kind of like ridiculous that I'm dragged into this talking about this medicine so much, because to me it's just like it's an old, relatively safe medicine. There's some studies behind it. They're not conclusive. It may turn out to be effective and hold up to the best gold standard trials. It may not. There's like other drugs that we started using too that I think are of benefit that I haven't talked about as much because they haven't been as controversial, like fenofibrate, for example, which I think is going to turn out to be a very effective drug in COVID-19 that was also part of our treatment protocol. It's traditionally used to treat high triglycerides, a type of high cholesterol. If people start running around accusing doctors using that of not knowing the difference between a virus and fat, I guess I'll have to talk about that more.
Does it come in paste form?
Yeah, you know, if it does, then we're going to be in a lot of trouble. Or like people promoting it as a miracle cure, then I guess that'll be a problem.
That is the issue, though. I mean, really, like, you know, again, I probably will not be changing me, you know, mocking the people taking the horse paste, because again, I'm talking about the people taking the horse paste. I mean, the fact that it just happens to be ivermectin is inconsequential, because to me, that drug is not the issue. It's the fact that people are taking horse paste.
I know.
If it was any other drug that came in, you know, and I actually have been mocking this other thing. It hasn't happened yet, but I assume it will. Last week, that vet who called into the show to talk to me, veterinarian, he told me that there was a study in Brazil and it's starting to gain traction. I just saw this week, so I was like, oh wow, we had it on our show last week before any English language outlets started talking about it. But I saw this week Reuters or AP brought it up. There's a study in Brazil that some sort of Brazilian snake has there's some sort of feature in their venom, not the venom itself, but something in the venom that apparently when, inserted into a COVID cell or whatever, you could probably explain it more, being that it looks like from your reaction, you know what I'm talking about, is really effective at fighting COVID-19. Now, obviously, this is something that they are looking into. It seems very, very preliminary. And if there was anything they could do with this, it would involve them extracting that thing and finding, you know, that whatever's in that venom, and creating some sort of medicine from just that thing. But I joked that, watch, you're going to see anti-vaxxers find out about this, read this news story, and you'll be hearing about all these people buying up snakes and forcing venomous snakes to bite them and to cure COVID. Yeah. And then we're going to have this whole thing where all these anti-vaxxers are showing up at poison control, dying of venom, you know, from snakes. It's just, you know, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Bill Gates just wants you to get a vaccine because he doesn't want you to know the truth that a weekly snake bite will prevent you from getting
COVID. Right. It's, you know, it's crazy. Yeah. And, you know, another thing too, the idea, like, listen, I'm as far as I know, I'm a relatively healthy guy in my 30s. But I know people who are immunocompromised. My parents are in their 60s and I was worried about them throughout the pandemic, obviously. But we never had to do any, like, regimen. We stayed home during the lockdowns. We lived our life under, like we usually would do at home, with some differences. Obviously not going out and getting food as much as we used to, things like that. We wore masks when we went out, once people started going out more. And then when the vaccines came out, my parents got theirs first because they were older. And then when I was eligible and my other family members were eligible, we got the vaccine as well. That is how COVID affected us in terms of, and obviously there's still ongoing stuff. We still wear masks. We still don't go out as much yet, but we're pretty much close to normal. But the people who are the anti-vaxxers who've been decrying about how there's this great reset and people want there to be this new normal, and these anti-vaxxers are the ones who are steadfast about going back to how life was before the pandemic as if it never happened, they're the ones who are like changing their lifestyle with these regimens. Yeah. Like they take like multiple different medications a day, it seems like. They're taking, you know, you mentioned that some of these legit or positive looking studies saw people taking like ivermectin pill like once a month or something like that. You got people talking about their regimen is doing this and that in addition to a once a day spoonful of the ivermectin horse paste. It's like so bizarre. It's like, listen, just if you get the vaccine, you can have your dream of getting back pretty close to life prior to the pandemic, because that's what is the recommended thing to do to get back there. I mean, it's just so crazy to me.
Yeah, and you know, the anti-vaccine misinformation has really, and the fact that's gone hand in hand with not just this drug, but anything. There's people who think that as long as you take niacin, you can't get COVID. There's people who think as long as you take enough vitamin D, you can't get COVID. There's people who think, oh, they've got their, oh yeah, I just want to go back to normal. But yeah, here's my quercetin, here's my N-acetylcysteine, here's my vitamin D, here's my vitamin C, here's my zinc, here's my L-glutathione, here's my L-arginine. Or I could go get a shot in my arm that has, you know, extremely high efficacy of keeping me out of the hospital, out of the morgue, and killing somebody else with this illness, and mRNA and vector-based vaccines, adenovirus, probably the safest vector delivery of vaccines that we've ever had, higher efficacy than we really probably could have asked for a vaccine against a coronavirus. And I think a lot of it involves, I think there's several different dynamics here that are important to think about, like things like the VAERS database. Now, the reason the Vaccine Adverse Reporting System exists in the first place is anti-vaxxers and the constant accusations that the government is hiding bad reactions to vaccines. So they create this very publicly open, available system where anybody can go report, either a healthcare professional or a family member or you can report an event, and it's publicly available and you can tally them all up. Now, the problem with that system is obviously these A are not causative. They have to be verified and they have to be run through the appropriate statistical tests to show if they represent some kind of rise above the baseline of how many things you would expect. So if you're giving a vaccine or even a saline injection or any intervention to almost 200 million people, you're going to expect to see a certain number of heart attacks. You're going to expect to see a certain number of strokes, blood clots, episodes of tinnitus, and all these other things, because they have annual population incidences that you will expect. And you have to see in a controlled setting if you see things rising above expected levels. And when you properly filter and test this data and run it through the appropriate epidemiological techniques, you find out these are actually very, very safe. But people go running around spreading this VAERS data. This is how many deaths to cause. This is how many heart attacks. This is how many strokes, et cetera, et cetera. And people don't know the difference. The other kind of stupid take on VAERS is that, oh, everything people are reporting in that system is fake, and anybody can go on that site and just make up anything they want. And my response to that is, like, technically, yeah, they can and they do from time to time. But it's almost like the myth of, like, voter fraud. Like, that's not what's – you can actually be prosecuted for falsely reporting a vaccine adverse event on the VAERS database. And I think that's – I think the majority is that, no, these are actually reactions that are happening, but they are just things that may be temporally related to getting the vaccine but not causative. And it takes – much more of a sophisticated approach to actually determine causation. When you do the appropriate controlled research, you find that these things are very safe. They're not perfect. There are people out there who have bad vaccine reactions. Anybody telling you that not one single person has had a serious reaction to this vaccine is being absurd. That just does not happen with any intervention. But the rates of are so low that I tell people who are hesitant, like, your individual risk of going and getting a vaccine and having some horrific thing happen from it is unbelievably low. And any horror story you're hearing from someone, what you're not hearing is the 100 million other people who got it and are completely fine. And you have to think of your term in terms of risk and the likelihood that, especially with Delta and how contagious this thing is, dude, you're getting COVID. We're all going to come in contact with this thing and it's going to infect us. And it's a matter of, are you immunized or are you not? And I told you I work with long haulers.
I was about to ask you about that. Yep.
There are people who are young and healthy who don't even get that sick. They never go to the hospital. They got a cold for maybe a week. Maybe they're in bed a couple of days. And a year later, they're still debilitated because they have chest palpitations, shortness of breath, brain fog, confusion, tingling, burning sensations in their arms and legs, can't go up a flight of stairs, can't pick up and play with their kids, can't think well enough to hold down a job. This virus does all kinds of funky, crazy shit to human physiology that we're still figuring out. You don't want to mess around with this thing.
Do we know why? Because, you know, you got a cold or flu, and, you know, the right loves to compare COVID to the flu. So let's do that here. Let's play that game. You know, when you get a cold or flu, I'm sure people who get very sick and go to the hospital, if you're older especially, things like that can be serious, obviously. But for the most part, when you beat it, you beat it. What do we know why there are these cases where people are just, it seems like they might be stuck with COVID-19 related symptoms for life?
Mm-hmm. I don't know if for life, but certainly very prolonged. So we call it, the official term is PASC, post-acute sequelae of COVID-19. And it actually brings up very interesting questions about the concept of what we call pathogen persistence. So when you recover from an illness from certain types of bacteria or viruses, do those viruses or pieces of them or those pathogens stick around in parts of your immune system and continue to cause problems? And the sort of academic mainstream, what I call the ivory tower of science and medicine, has been very resistant to that concept. But there's a lot of microbiologists, immunologists who are studying that concept and have been for a long time. In COVID-19, this is what we're seeing. What we're seeing is that pieces of that SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, and a particular subunit of that protein, they just stick around in what we call your antigen-presenting cells, your monocytes, your macrophages. And the job of these cells is basically to be almost like tattletales, and they go around, more like they're something between a tattletale and a garbage truck. They go around and kind of looking for things that aren't supposed to be there, and they present them to your immune system for your immune system to then fight and attack. And what it seems like is that these pieces of that dead virus just are persisting in our antigen-presenting cells, and they are just causing this prolonged, unremitting, constant state of inflammation. And because that inflammation is taking place in the lining of blood vessels, it's causing what we refer to as small vessel vasculitis, so inflammation of blood vessels. Everywhere in our body needs a blood supply, and so literally it can affect any symptom, cause just any system, and cause just about any symptom. So neuroinflammation causing things like brain fog and confusion, in the heart causing things like chest pain, in the lungs, shortness of breath, in the nerves and the small fibers that make up our nerves, causing issues with balance and gait and you know, tingling, numbness, loss of sensation. And so we're experimenting with different types and studying different types of medicines, trying to get that process to stop and trying to get those antigen presenting cells to stop signaling for inflammation. Another really important aspect of COVID long haul disease, which may be connected to that persistence of pathogens, is that it really makes our platelets go nuts. Our platelets are a crucial type of blood cell involved in clotting and coagulation. And without platelets, we would bleed in severe platelet depletion. People can bleed to death. With excessive activation and aggregation of platelets, you can actually lose blood supply because they clog and block arteries. And when they did autopsy studies of patients who had recovered with COVID-19, they found that the sort of parent precursor cell, the platelets, were built up in the capillaries of circulation in the brain, in occluding them. And so there's a bunch of clotting factors that are involved in this COVID long haul disease. And then there's basically chronic inflammation from the persistence of the pathogen, where the body just seems to not clear it very well. And so this is very cutting edge stuff. We're still learning more about it. Hopefully we're going to start learning about potential therapies to get people better. But for right now, you're at risk, not necessarily of die. Like if you're a relatively young, healthy person, the likelihood you're going to get COVID and die is pretty low, but it's been estimated that something like 1 in 3 people who get infected with this thing will end up with some kind of post-acute sequelae, and that can last anywhere from a few months to, like, I have patients who got COVID maybe in March of 2020. They're still not right.
Jeez. Wow. I mean, it's amazing that they're, you know, those people, I'm sure, quite a few of them, if they had the vaccine available to them, they would have been happy to get it and avoid these long-term issues that they're dealing with. And the fact that there's people who can get the vaccine today who have not yet got COVID and are instead taking all of the different medications being promoted by grifters, it's sad. It's just so sad to see, because every time you see all these deaths that have been coming and out in the past couple of months, and it's, I honestly was, and maybe I would love to hear your take on this. When the vaccine, you know, as a doctor who's been going through this, has been dealing with patients with COVID for so long now, did you think that we would be at the point we are now, where we are, in my estimation, going to end up, maybe, if not worse than, which is totally possible, close to the worst of the worst of the this past winter in the coming months?
I would not have expected that, no.
It's,
I know a lot of epidemiologists did, but I would not. I'll be honest with you. I'm not going to lie and say, yes, I was expecting this. I was not.
It's amazing. Like, it's, I didn't think we would get back to how, you know, it would just be like that and everyone would listen, but I had no idea that, you know, I guess the combination of the Delta variant being so strong, I don't know how to explain it, but...
It's getting the ability of the virus to stick to you is getting stronger, and ordinarily a virus will evolve to become less virulent and more contagious. Because if you're a virus, any being, any entity wants to keep living and replicating. So you don't necessarily want to kill your host. You want your host to cough you and breathe you out in the air and, you know, spread you. You don't want to drop. But the problem with this is that it's not really the viral illness that's killing people. It is like the dead viral fragments causing reactogenicity and hyperinflammation. And it seems like that's not getting any, that's not lightening up so much. It's becoming more contagious. I think to broaden the discussion, you mentioned variants, and that's very important because we're having this discussion and we're like the media and everyone's like hyper-focused on like these anti-vaxxers in high-income countries where there's a vaccine and they won't get it and they're the problem. And like really where the variants are coming from is lower and middle-income countries that do not have much vaccine uptake, right? Something like the poorest countries in the world that make up 20% of global population have been allocated around 2% of the vaccine supply. And with this disease transmitting, it mutates, and that's going to continue to throw variants at us. And the more variants we get, the less well the vaccines may hold up to protecting against transmission. If we didn't have variants and we had been more aggressive about the just and equitable allocation of vaccines globally, we may have been okay. Like, these things were so efficacious that even if we had this little anti-vax community, like, we probably could have approached herd immunity. And if we continue to hyper-focus and now booster shots, high-income countries, vaccinate, sell them to all the high-income countries, and we continue to leave all these other parts of the world not well-vaccinated, this thing isn't going anywhere. And I think I would like to see more attention from mainstream media on the absolute moral travesty of the hoarding of vaccines of the high-income countries of the world and the poor and unjust and non-equitable allocation of these to the other parts of the country in terms of how unfair and immoral that is, but also in the fact that we're not going to be able to vaccinate our way out of this thing unless we protect all the different parts of the world. And so when I hear all this ire and anger at the anti-vaccine community, and I understand it, you're a healthcare worker, you're getting slammed, it's your third wave, come on, just get vaccinated. Like, we don't need to be going through this right now. I get it. But I think we need to broaden our scope a little bit and see from a bigger perspective what's really going on here and what's going to continue to go on if we don't, as a species, get our act together.
We could go another hour and a half on everything you just mentioned there. So I think that's the perfect place to leave this episode. I really appreciate you taking the time. I mean, I really wanted to have someone on this show to really – I mean, this show deals with – you know, a lot of, debunking misinformation and different things like, and different conspiracy theories out there. And so I thought it was extra important, not just to get, the lowdown on these groups that are inappropriately promoting this sort of miracle cure that does not exist. I thought it was also important to get someone who does see some, interesting positive effects from the studies that have been conducted on this medicine, so people could really get the full scope of what's going on here. So, and you provided that perfectly. So, Dr. Eric Osgood, thank you so much for joining me on this show and taking the time. Where can people find you to continue to follow your work?
Yeah, no problem. One last quick thing. Is it okay if I say one last quick thing? I mentioned those virologists who very first studied this virus and ivermectin in the monkey kidney cells. They since have been working on human lung tissue to see if in human tissue ivermectin might work at more reachable concentrations. They've completed their research. They are preparing it for peer review. And we might get a very different answer now that those researchers have looked at human tissue. They're very hush-hush about it. They do not allow for the pre-peer review dissemination of their research findings. But people should look out for that from Monash University, because we might learn something very different about the concentrations of this medicine that might be effective in humans based on some of this new research. And so I would be on the lookout for that. That may be interesting. And then on the majority report, I am the show to say, hey, there's going to be an interesting Senate testimony in a few days. A friend of mine is going to talk about this drug. And you read that IM out loud.
Oh, yeah?
Was on the show.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I thought you might appreciate that.
Oh,
yeah.
Perfect.
People can find me, Dr. Eric Osgood, MD, on Twitter. I talk a lot of shit on Twitter, and I try to make funny jokes and occasionally drop serious medical topics and conversation on there, too. And if anybody in the New Jersey area has clinical questions or needs any help medically, drohsogood@gmail.com, drohsogood, drohsogood@gmail.com. So drop me an email if I can be of help. And really, thanks a lot for having me on, man. It's been great talking to you.
Oh, my pleasure. Have a great night. Enjoy the scenery. I love wherever you I love that background. It looks so nice.
It's my backyard.
And thank you for, I'm nice backyard. I have no backyard living in Queens, so I'm certainly looking at that. I'm salivating over all that space you got back there now.
Come hang out anytime, man. Open invitation. Come down.
Oh, I love it.
Jersey.
I love it. Good. Thank you for all the work you've done, too, with, taking care of people with COVID. I'm sure it's been very difficult year and a half. So keep safe, keep healthy. Talk to you again soon.
Sounds great, man. Great to meet you.
Have a good night.
Meet you too, man.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. Bloop, bloop. There we go. That was, I felt bad for keeping him so long, but I had a doctor on who was part of that group or was, a consultant to that group, the FLCCC. And I really felt like, wow, if we could get a really nice, well-rounded, factual, legitimate discussion about why the medical community is actually looking at ivermectin and then what different grifters and zealots have done to basically turn people to horse paste, I'm going to take advantage and keep him for as long as he wants. So we will now go to the second half of the show. You will not notice anything different if you're listening to the live stream or if you're a patron. You go to patreon.com/Matt Binder to support this show. patreon.com/Matt Binder. I'm going to shout out the people who've become patrons since the last episode of this program last Thursday. Ryan H, Vinny H, Jess from the West, John F, KK, Alicia W, and Gabriel W. Thank you all so much for becoming patrons to this show. I always really appreciate people who financially support this show because obviously that is a big ask to financially support anything, really. So it means a lot to me, really. And it's the, it's September 2nd now, the first of the month was yesterday. Just got the, when Patreon charges everybody. So as usual, we lose people from declines and stuff like that. So again, if you can't afford to become a patron subscriber, please take care of yourself and your family first. Come join when you can do so. For everyone who's financially able to, what's taking you so long? Let's do it. Let's do it. Sign up. Patreon.com/Matt Binder. And if you can't afford to subscribe, but do want to give a little one-off payment, YouTube.com/Matt Binder. Hop into the chat in the live stream right now and drop a super chat. Ooh, that was a mouthful. I'll read all the super chat comments. Also, if you're listening live, open up your Skype program and type in Doomed Live, and you can call into the show very shortly. I'll be signing into the phone system during the break. Well, we will be taking in just a minute. If you're more of a podcast listener, go to doomedcast.com and you can download the audio version of this show. Usually goes up maybe a day or two after the live stream. But if you like listening while traveling or on your commute or whatever, doomedcast.com is the place to download or find the links to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or whatever. What else? Oh, ratethispodcast.com/doomed. Go there and you can leave an review on all the links there that will bring you to the various podcast directories where you can leave reviews, such as Apple Podcasts. Let me read one of the wonderful reviews that I got just this past week. Again, leaving a review helps people find this program. It helps bring the show's rankings up in these directories. So please do so if you have a minute. Let's read this one. From Bet Docs, falling down our rabbit hole. I thoroughly enjoy this podcast and many others that Will Sommer and Jared Holt appear on as we watch and are somehow constantly amazed at the right wing. Ah, you're a fan of the guests of this show. I'll take it. It could swap me out, I guess, right? But I'll take it. Let me continue. Love the chatter and am sometimes shocked at how I'm still shocked at the rhetoric and the grift. Listen, I actually am quite proud of the guests that I get on this show. So I look at that truly as a compliment because guests make this show possible too. Thank you for the review. Please leave one if you haven't already. What else? I don't know anymore. I don't know anymore. It's September already. Can you believe it? Summer's almost over. Let's go to the second half of the show. We'll all take calls. I'll read super chats. Maybe a story or two, depending on how much time we got. To the freebie listeners, this is where I bid you adieu. Patrons and live stream viewers, stick around. Don't go anywhere. If you're not in those two groups, though, I will see you all next time. On Doomed.